Take your Bibles this morning with me and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 22. 1 Samuel 16, 6 and 7. Well, I've used it several times up to this point in time, but let me read it again to you. It says, "And it came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab," and he meaning Samuel, "and said, Surely Yahweh's anointed is before him. But Yahweh said unto Samuel, Look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For Yahweh seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but Yahweh looketh on the heart." We're obviously returning to the series, A Man After Yahweh's Own Heart. This will be part 10. It's possibly, in fact, I should probably say, it's probably, without hardly any question whatsoever, more important than probably anything else in this series, that we understand that because the issues of life spring from the heart, that it's principally our hearts, as this verse would certainly seem to declare, to which Yahweh looks and evaluates us. So the all-important question that we should be asking ourselves throughout this series and at other times as well is, what does he see when he looks at our hearts? Not just David's hearts. Let's not just, again, remove ourselves from the story, but let's take what we need to take from it and let us ask the question, what does he see when he looks at my heart? And be careful, because your heart can deceive you about your heart. Isn't that what Jeremiah says, that the heart is more deceitful than all else, and who can understand it? You've got to be careful when you say, oh, my heart is definitely one like David's. Well, be careful, because your heart just might be deceiving you. If it's not a heart after or like his, or at least sincerely desirous of working to achieve a heart like his, no matter what we do or how we appear outwardly, we are no better than the Pharisees in Yeshua's day, whom he considered whitened sepulchres, who appeared beautiful on the outside, but who were full of dead men's bones. And I think I pointed out in one of the earlier messages, you know, can you imagine digging up a sepulcher, what do we call them today? A coffin today that's been in the ground for maybe a year and a half, 2 years, taking a look inside. That's the description that God uses. When the heart's not right and everything looks beautiful on the outside, it's just a coffin with a bunch of dead bones. We're the living dead. Without a heart like his, we're just the living, walking dead, full of dead men's bones. You know, I think among many modern Judeo-Christians, or I think that many modern Judeo-Christians have a heart for Yahweh, but they have no works, no real works that spring forth from that heart. They just enjoy delighting in the Lord. Now, hopefully you know what I'm talking about, and enjoy being with others who delight in the Lord. Our churches are full of church. I mean, that's church services today. The majority of modern Christianity is simply people who love delighting in the Lord and being with others who delight in the Lord, which is ultimately nothing more, if you really think about where Christianity is today, is delighting in their own delight. And they're really not delighting in the Lord at all. They're just delighted in their delight in the Lord. While on the other hand, I'm afraid that many in Christian Israel who are out doing, or at least trying to do something for their king and their kingdom, on the other hand, don't have a heart like his, which ultimately amounts to nothing more than building their own kingdom. You know, just as we must worship Yahweh in spirit and truth, remember, faith without works is dead. But so is works without faith, or without a heart that deeply believes and loves Yahweh Yeshua. Let's not get so work-oriented that we remove ourselves from the heart matter of it, or become so truth-oriented that we remove ourselves from the spirit aspect of our worship of our God. It's got to be the balance of both, but God principally looks at the heart first. As we have observed, David was such a man of both heart and works, as any man or woman with a heart after Yahweh's must be as well. We left off in the last message in 1 Samuel chapter 21 in a discussion concerning David's temporary lapse of faith and courage when he first fled from Saul. And probably, as I pointed out, so that he wouldn't have to kill Saul. Because that's the situation that he was faced with, either be killed or kill. And I don't think, again, as I pointed out in the previous message, that he ran out of fear for his own life. He ran out of fear because he didn't want to have to be forced to King Saul. However, his faith nevertheless appeared to have to waver when he fled to Achish, king of the Philistines. And if you recall, rather than simply trusting Yahweh, David went so far in that situation, in his fear, to feign himself as a madman. Now, I say that David had a temporary lapse of faith and courage because, as we will see, he eventually returns to Achish in faith and sanity. He eventually ends up back there, where the Bible doesn't tell us, but as I also pointed out in the last message, the only thing that makes sense of his going there is that he had been told to go there by Yahweh. But when he gets there, he says, this doesn't make sense. And instead of accepting what Yahweh had told him to do in faith, he depended on his own sense or possibly what others were counseling him, and telling him and saying, David, this doesn't make any sense. You know, much like the apostles did with the greater David, if you remember, when he was going back to where Herod was looking for him, he said, listen, Herod is looking for you. But they were looking at it from at least what they thought was a perspective of sense, instead of a perspective of faith. And David, when he started looking at it rather than from the perspective of faith, really lost all sense. He not only feigned himself as a madman, in a sense he became a madman, because he trusted in his own sense rather than in the counsel of God himself. Achish, it was a temporary lapse of faith and courage because he does eventually end up there. And from there, when he finally gets there, we'll see that Yahweh was also able to use his quote-unquote alliance with the Philistines to protect his people, to allow David to protect his people, and also to further the kingdom of God. But that, of course, all comes later on and not in this message. Achish, at this point, doesn't want another madman in his kingdom. And so, and believing that he has nothing to fear from a madman, he simply cast David out of his kingdom. And consequently, David then finds himself on the run all over again, all because of his temporary lapse of faith. And so, like his forefathers, after they had left Egypt, who found themselves time and again through that 40-year period, taking another lap around Mount Sinai until they learned the lesson. And so David finds himself in the same situation or predicament. And if we're honest with ourselves, don't we often find ourselves out in the wilderness, you know, symbolically taking another lap around Mount Sinai, when it was a straight shot right into the Canaan land, few days march. And instead, they just keep circling around Mount Sinai, needing to learn the lesson again. There's a song called Walk in Sinai. I always thought it was another lap around Sinai, and you'll see why. But there's a song entitled Walkin' Sinai, sung, and I'm going to play it to you this time with this recording, sung by Mark Reynolds. And I think you'll hopefully appreciate and learn the lesson. We can learn the lesson from the song. If this is going to run for me. Okay, whoops, wrong one. Get this thing figured out.
Don't you know in the days of old, when the Israelites didn't do what they were told, because of their stubbornness, they had failed the test. When they wavered in their faith each time,
can you hear?
Whining and crying for a sign, Yahweh simply told them this. Go on and take another lap around Mount Sinai. You've learned your lesson. Please stop your whining and you with your rebelling. Till
learn to stand in your death and soon my trust and obey Yahweh. Have you ever been in a situation where you asked you to wait upon him, but it seemed you could not remain still? Started planning what you're gonna do, cause you thought Yahweh had forgotten you, just as you heard these words. Go on and take another lap around Mount Sinai. You've learned your lesson. It's time you're whining and you with your rebelling. Do you learn to stand in your death testing, but trusting and obeying Yahweh? Son, you gotta take another step of faith and trust me to carry you through the storm. When the storm started getting rough, I thought Yahweh wasn't strong enough, so I started doing things on my own. Then he said, take another lap around Mount Sinai. You've learned your lesson. You stop your whining and you quit your rebelling. Stand in your day of testing by trusting and obeying Yahweh. Go on and take another lap around Mount Sinai. You've learned your lesson. You stop your whining and you quit your rebelling. Do you learn to stand in your day of testing by trusting and obeying Yahweh? By trusting and
quite a lesson in that song. I'm sure a lesson that we need to learn. How many times, you know, again, would it just be better to trust him and take the straight shot to wherever he wants? And no, we've got to learn the lesson, and he just sends us one more time around Mount Sinai. Well, in David's case, it wasn't another trip or lap around Mount Sinai, but through the wilderness, or through the wilderness and then around Mount Sinai, but another trip through the wildernesses of Maon and Gedi and Ziph, as we follow him through this time until he ends up back where I think Yahweh intended him to be in the first place, through all of these different wildernesses on the run until he finally learns the lesson. Now, with that in mind, let's pick up the account with 1 Samuel chapter 22. And initially, I just want to concentrate on the first two verses. And what I want to point out from these two verses, or what I want you to note from these two verses, is not so much about David, who we know was a type of Christ, but instead I want you to take a look at the men that's described in verse 2 particularly, who attach themselves to David, who I believe, the Bible doesn't tell us this, but who I believe are also a type of those who often attach themselves to Christ, the greater David, as he's sometimes known as. 1 Samuel chapter 22, beginning with verse 1, it says, David therefore departed thence, and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. So, to begin with, his family joins up with him. Then verse 2, and it says, and every one that was in distress, and every one that was in debt, and every one that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And shortly it increased to 600 men. We may read about that a little bit later. Now, I believe that these 400 are some of the very men, if not the very men, that we find described in the latter part of Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews 11, 33 through 38, it says, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. You think about these 400 men, 600 men, and others. Women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting the release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. And then verse 38 in particular, where it says, men of whom this world is not worthy. Don't miss that part of it. But then it says, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And isn't it at the cave of Adullam that these 400 men join up with David? I think it's some of those men that are described there in Hebrews chapter 11. In 1 Chronicles 11, where we're provided the names of David's mighty men, we are told in verse 15 there that three of the 30 captains, three of the 30 mighty men or captains were with David at the cave of Adullam. These initial 40 men, including three of those who were later identified as David's mighty men, are once again described in verse 2 here of 1 Samuel chapter 22 as men who were in distress, in debt, and discontented. These guys sound a whole lot like outlaws, at least to Saul and his government. Discontented, in distress, and in debt. And I suspect the in debt there was back taxes to the government, more so than in debt to probably other individuals. Discontented, in distress, and in debt. Sound familiar? Sound like someone you may know, possibly. Maybe even yourself. Maybe you can relate to these fellows who join themselves up with Yahweh, and I hope you can. And that may at least initially seem like a strange thing to say, that you might be able to relate to these fellows. But let me ask you, who were these men in distress over, in debt to, and discontented with? Well, Saul, it would appear, or the government that he represented of that day, right? Now, here's what I want you to think about or consider from these two verses. Much of modern Christendom teaches that Christians are obligated to submit to any and all government authority that Yahweh has placed over them at any given time. Heard that before? Of course, I've devoted a whole book called Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government to that doctrine as to their distortion of Romans 13, 1 through 7, where they supposedly come up with that doctrine, or at least one of the places. But that's what the majority of Judeo-Christianity is teaching today. But let me ask you, what was Saul... let me put it this way. Was not Saul the government that Yahweh had placed over those 400 men at that time? And were they not therefore in rebellion to that same government? You think Saul was happy that they had gone to David and joined up with David? You think he had blessed them and said, go, my young men, be blessed and be with David? I don't think so. And somebody's probably going to respond and say, yeah, that's true. But not only had Saul been anointed by Yahweh as king, but so had David. And it was David who was chosen and given preeminence over Saul. And furthermore, you can't serve two masters, for you'll either hate the one and love the other, or else you'll hold the one and despise the other. And my response to that is, precisely. And therefore, can you not only see how ridiculous, but how unscriptural the doctrine of unconditional submission to government authority or to anyone other than God is? Now, it's true that no one rules except by the permission yea, even by the commission, of Yahweh Almighty. It's Daniel chapter 4 and verse 17 again. It says, "The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basest of men." As I've pointed out previously, I think, in this series, the good, the bad, and the ugly, sometimes. And sometimes, as we find it today, the evil and the lesser of two evils. I don't know if you've noticed how both Bush and Kerry are labeling each other as bad guys in this election season we find ourselves. And I don't know about you, but I get the feeling that this time they both might be just telling the truth. They're both bad guys. Because they're far removed from what God intends them to be, I guarantee you, no matter how much, how big, how good the facade is on the outside. It's true. It's a fact that even the worst of the worst are in power by Yahweh's design and permission for His ultimate sovereign purposes. Even the worst of the worst. But here's the rhetorical question that we need to give some serious thought to. While Bill Clinton, for example, was on his throne, or while George Bush is on his throne, was and is Yeshua on his throne, ruling over the affairs of men? And who, may I ask? Again, that was a rhetorical question. I think we all have got it figured out, and I think probably everybody knows the answer to that, at least those who claim to be Christians. And who, may I ask, had or has the preeminence? Bill Clinton, George Bush, or Yeshua the Christ? Now, there's not a Christian alive who can't answer those, provide the correct answer for all of those questions. And in like manner, it's true that we cannot serve two masters. When or where, at least, they are in conflict or opposed to each other. For we'll either hate the one and love the other, or else hold the one and despise the other. We cannot serve two masters. The fact is, when Yeshua is understood and honored, not just understood, but truly honored for who He is, it will inevitably, at some time, produce some outlaws with any non-Christian or anti-Christian government in power at the time. Just as it did in David's day in the first century, as recorded in Acts, especially in chapters 4, 5, and 17. The fact is, it will ultimately come down to, and for some sooner than later, but it will ultimately come down to that true Christians will eventually find themselves outlaws to an ungodly, illegitimate, counterfeit government, because they only get worse until something's done about it. Or they will find themselves outlaws with God. We're facing that more and more in this day and age. Take the homosexual situation we've got today. It's happened in Canada. It's recently happened in Switzerland. They're trying to make it happen here in the United States, where if I preach against homosexuality, if I read from the Scriptures what God says, His condemnation, His judgment of death upon sodomites, that I can go to prison for it. They just sent someone in Switzerland, and they dealt with someone, a preacher. It was a preacher in Switzerland. It was a Christian up in Canada that here a couple of years ago they dealt with. That's what it's coming down to, is that as this government progressively becomes more non-Christian, becomes more brazen, becomes more antichrist, that either we will be outlaws with it, or we will be outlaws with God. Now, that's not to say that Christians are never to submit to government, where any government at any given time is in line or harmonic with Yahweh's laws, we are obliged to submit to government in those areas, because in those areas they would be a representative of God and His laws. In other words, so much as it depends upon us, we are to be at peace with all men, but not at the expense, Lord forbid, of obedience to our God, King, Judge, and Lawgiver. And therefore, like the men who attached themselves to the lesser David, there will also be men and women who attach themselves to the greater David, who will likewise be considered outlaws by the government of their day. Men and women like those described in Acts 17, verses 6 and 7, who are described as having turned their world upside down, and who all did contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one, Yeshua, who didn't recognize Caesar in his ungodly government any more than the men who attached themselves to David recognized Saul, even though he had been once anointed, put in place by God himself, as all government authority is. Now, the remainder of 1 Samuel chapter 22, we just dealt with the first two verses there, but I wanted to really center on verse 2, because I believe those men are a type of those who attach themselves to the greater David in this day and age as well. And, boy, there's going to be a weeding out period of time coming. And it's happening as we sit here today on certain issues like homosexuality and other issues. But the weeding out is going to become more prevalent. The polarization between true Christians, those who truly have attached themselves to follow Yeshua wherever he leads, and those who have just given him lip service are going to become more distinct as time goes on. The remainder of 1 Samuel 22 is principally devoted to Doeg the Edomite's betrayal of Ahimelech and his fellow priest, and also David's care and protection of Ahimelech's son Abiathar, which, of course, we addressed in a previous message, and therefore we can skip over the rest of 1 Samuel 22. Therefore, let's proceed now with this account from 1 Samuel chapter 23, beginning with verse 1. It says, "And then David They told David, saying, Behold, the Philistines fight against Keilah, and they rob the threshing floors. And therefore David inquired of Yahweh, saying, Shall I go and smite these Philistines? And Yahweh said unto David, Go and smite the Philistines and save Keilah." Now, a man after Yahweh's heart, like David, does not take on any task without consulting Yahweh first. For any man who acknowledges Yahweh for who he is, think about this, is an absolute fool. Any man who acknowledges Yahweh for who he is an absolute fool who would do otherwise. How else would you describe the man or woman who can tap into the infinite and doesn't do so? Now, if we're truthful, we're going to have to admit sometimes we're fools. Because do we tap into the infant with any decision that we have to make? Do we go to the Father first and tap into the infinite when we have the ability to do so? I have to admit, sometimes I haven't, and therefore I've been a fool. Because I've got the ability to do so, and I haven't sometimes done it. How many New Testament scriptures do we have that admonishes us to pray at all times about everything? I know some of them will come to mind. How many are there in the New Testament that admonish us to do so? And by doing so, don't miss this, that such a man can not only tap into the infinite, but he can also become intimate with the infinite. And someone might respond, oh, that's impossible. Become intimate with the infinite. Well, sad to say, obviously for them it has become impossible. However, Solomon in Proverbs 3 and verse 23 wrote, "For the crooked man is an abomination to Yahweh, but Yahweh is intimate with the righteous." All right, continuing in 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 3, and it says, "And David's men said unto him, Behold," now keep in mind, David's already gone to Yahweh, consulted with him, and God says, "Go, I'll deliver the Philistines into your hand." Verse 3, "And David's men said unto him, Behold, we are afraid here in Judah." So they were living at this time now in Judah. He says, "We're afraid here in Judah. How much more then if we come to Keilah against the armies of the Philistines?" Verse 4, "Then David inquired of Yahweh yet again. And Yahweh answered him and said, Arise and go down to Keilah, for I will deliver the Philistines into thy hand. Now David was ready right off the bat to immediately follow his general's orders, but he wavered. He doubted, did he not, for just a little while? Or if he hadn't, why would he have gone back the second time? What happened? Well, once again, as we pointed out in one of the previous two messages, he was filled with faith and confidence when he listened to the voice of Yahweh. However, he began to be filled with doubting and fear when he listened to the voice of men. Brethren, let us learn this extremely important lesson. Listening to the voice of men when it's not in accord with the voice of God, voice of Yahweh, will ultimately result in doubting and fear and ultimately in disobedience. That's why it is so extremely important that we baptize, immerse ourselves, not rantize or sprinkle ourselves, but immerse ourselves in His voice, in His words, in His Word on a daily basis, because we are daily immersed in man's voice all around us, aren't we? In the negative, pessimistic voice of men everywhere around us. We get it on the news, like I pointed out in one of the other messages. If you tend to be pessimistic, the last thing you need to do is listen to the evening news. And even if you're positive, you might be careful, because they'll tend to want you make you pessimistic. But that's why it is so important that we immerse ourselves in His voice daily, because otherwise we're being immersed in nothing but the voice of men, and it will ultimately lead to fear, doubting, and disobedience to the voice of God, as it did at least temporarily with David. Now, let me also point out on David's behalf that it's not necessarily wrong to inquire of Yahweh more than once on important matters. That is, so long as we eventually listen and obey. On the other hand, we also need to understand that if we do not eventually listen when He speaks, that the day may very well come when He doesn't listen when we speak. Zechariah chapter 7 and verse 13, and it came about that just as he called and they would not listen, so they called and I would not listen, saith Yahweh. Nothing wrong with double checking. That kind of comes with the human nature sometimes. That is, so long as we eventually listen and obey His voice. Verse 5, or let me say, praise Yahweh that David did, although he inquired twice, he eventually did obey, and he and his men were victorious over the Philistines, just as Yahweh had promised. Look at verse 5. So David and his men went to Keilah and fought with the Philistines and brought away their cattle and smote them with a great slaughter. So David saved the inhabitants of Keilah. Now, David had just delivered the Keilites, if you will. I don't know if that's what they called themselves, but that's what I'm going to call them. He just delivered them from the Philistines. Were they grateful? Well, I think they probably were for at least a while, until Saul was about to show up. Look at verses beginning with verse 6. And it came to pass, when Abiathar the son of Ahimelech fled to David to Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand. And it was told Saul that David was come to Keilah. And Saul said, Go, hath he delivered him, God has delivered him into mine hand. Notice too that Saul had his counselors who were saying that God is with you, Saul. You know, because that's what they said. And it was told Saul that David was come to Keilah, and Saul said, or I guess in this case it was Saul himself even still claiming it, God has delivered him into mine hand, for he is shut in by entering into the town that has gates and bars. And Saul called all the people together to war to go down to Keilah and besiege David and all his men. And David knew that Saul secretly practiced mischief against him, and he said to Abiathar the priest, Bring hither the ephod. And then said David, O Yahweh God of Israel, thy servant has certainly heard that Saul seeketh to come to Keilah to destroy the city for my sake. And he's even not so much concerned about himself again as he was for the city of Keilah. He says he's going to come down. You know, God, it appears that Saul's going to come down and destroy the city because I'm here. And with the men of Keilah, then he asked the question, verse 11, will the men of Keilah deliver me unto his hand? For something had given away these Keilites that they were maybe not as grateful as they should be and that they weren't maybe as trustworthy as they should be. And so he asked God, will they protect me here? He says, will Saul come down as thy servant has heard? O Yahweh, God of Israel, I beseech thee, tell thy servant. And Yahweh said, he will come down. And then said David, will the men of Keilah deliver me and my men into the hand of Saul? And Yahweh said, they will deliver thee up. He had just delivered them from the Philistines. And now God tells him that they will now deliver you to Saul. And then David and his men, verse 13, which were about 600, arose and departed out of Keilah and went whithersoever they could go. And it was told Saul that David was escaped from Keilah, and he forbade to go forth. The lesson in this is once again the middle verse of the entire Bible. Psalms 118, verse 8, where it said, it is better to trust in Yahweh than to put your confidence in man. While men are often fickle and therefore often undependable, Yahweh, praise his holy name, never changes. Micah 7, 18 and 20, it says, who is a God like unto thee? I mean, there isn't even another God, let alone men like him. That pardoneth iniquity and passes by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage. He retaineth not his anger forever, because he delighteth in mercy. He will turn again. He will have compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities. And thou wilt cast all their sin into the depths of the sea. Thou wilt perform thy truth to Jacob, and thy mercy to Abraham, which thou hast sworn unto our fathers from the days of old. God is dependable. His mercy will endure, at least for the remnant of his people. Now, I'm going to skip over at this point a lot of Saul's pursuit of David. But verse 14 of this chapter where we just left off pretty well sums it up. In verse 14 it says, and David abode in the wilderness in strongholds and remained in the mountain in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him every day. But God delivered him not into his hand. It says that Saul sought David every day. And I haven't looked up to see what the estimate of time is, but we're probably talking a period of years here. And it was constantly in the back of David's mind, and it was constantly on Saul's mind to kill David. Now, you talk about being consumed with hatred when it came to Saul. And know this, that if you permit hatred, ungodly hatred, that is, and there's a difference. There's godly hatred and there's ungodly hatred. But if you allow ungodly hatred to get a toehold in your life, and if you don't address it and repent of it, eventually that hatred will find a stronghold in your life, and it will consume your life as well. That is an attribute of hatred. Moreover, it will not only poison you, but it will poison those around you as well. Hebrews 12 and verse 15, it says, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Have you ever witnessed the fulfillment of that verse? Boy, I sure have. I've witnessed a whole family, and others as well around them, poisoned by the bitterness of just one of them. And they all became embittered. And that's why we're admonished by Paul in Ephesians 4, verses 31 and 32, to let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and evil speaking but be put away from you with all malice. And be ye kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake have forgiven you. It's because Christians today don't fulfill that verse that churches are split today. I've heard of a local church here not too long ago that split. Guaranteed, it was for part of this reason. They let hatred and bitterness, instead of kindness and forgiving one another, even as God has forgiven them, be the rule in their lives. Thank God we haven't had that problem. But I'll guarantee it's a problem throughout this country. in many, many cases where people allow bitterness to take hold of them and it spreads from them to the next person, to the next person, to the next person. Now, that's not a lesson from David, but rather one from Saul. On the other hand, I guess you could say it is a lesson from David because David was the antithesis of that. It's just a matter of whether we're going to learn the lesson from the negative, or we're going to learn from the negative example of Saul, or from the positive example of David. Whichever, I don't care. Let's just learn the lesson. Because you'll be like Saul if you ever let hatred and bitterness get a toehold and later a stronghold in your life. By the way, Saul's hatred and unceasing pursuit of David, I'm sure, was also meant to be a lesson for David as well. Had, if you think about it, had David but trusted Yahweh and kept his head and abode with Achish in Philistia, his bouts with Saul would have probably all but ended. Because it's extremely unlikely that Saul would have pursued David in Gath, where he would have had to take on the whole Philistine nation to contend with him. And see, God had a purpose for sending him to the Philistines at that point in time. And therefore, I think God was saying, David, you're going to learn a lesson here. It's best not to have to keep taking a trip around Mount Sinai. You know, it would have been a whole lot better off if you just trusted me. Learn the lesson in the first place rather than having to learn the lesson the hard way. You know, God seems to make sure that we learn the lesson one way or the other way. We can learn it the easy way by trusting Him, you know, the first time. Or He says, I'll let you learn it the hard way. And in this case, you know, David, he just had to keep taking another trip around the mountain, which is literally what occurred in this instance. Go back to chapter 23. Let's pick it up with verse 24. And it says, and they arose and went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon. So now he's been in three wildernesses already at this time. In the plain of the south of Jeshimon. Verse 25, Saul also and his men went to seek him once again. And they told David wherefore he came down unto a rock and abode in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued David in the wilderness of Maon. Verse 26, and it says, and Saul went on this side of the mountain, and David and his men on that side of the mountain. And David made haste to get away for fear of Saul, for Saul and his men were compassed David and his men around about to take them. So David, you ever played, get away behind a tree? You know, you've always got to stay on the opposite side of the tree to stay away. And that's what David was doing, just taking another trip around the mountain over and over and over again, God trying to get the lesson through to him. Notice also that in this last verse, it also says that David made haste to get away for fear of Saul, for Saul and his men compassed David and his men around about to take him. And in this particular case, even though I don't believe that he fled from Saul in the first place because of fear of Saul, but rather fear that he'd have to kill Saul, I think in this case it's real fear. Because genuine fear on David's part, in this case, because David, instead of being in obedience at this stage in his life, is in a sense in disobedience out there in the wilderness. And we are always in danger and likely to fear what we shouldn't when we find ourselves in disobedience to God. It's another very important lesson. When obedient to God, He can, and get this, when in obedience to God, He can hide us and even protect us, even in the midst of our enemies, as David would have been and later finds himself with Achish, the king of the Philistines. But when in disobedience, all of heaven sometimes can't protect us. And in fact, it's heaven itself that we maybe need to be most fear of when we're in such a state at such times. Men and wives, don't let this important lesson get by you. It's not so much important what our outward circumstances are or what they appear to be, but what's important is that we're in obedience to God, because God is even able to protect us if we're obedient in the midst of the worst of all enemies. Verses 27 and 29 of the same chapter. It says, but there came a messenger unto Saul, saying, haste thee and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land. Wherefore Saul returned from pursuing after David, and went against the Philistines. And therefore they called that place Sila Hamalakoth. I'm sure I've got that perfect. Verse 29, it says, "And David went up from thence and dwelt in strongholds at En-Gedi." Now, I want to stop here with this message, even though we still have a little bit of time. But I want to stop here because there's something special that occurs at En-Gedi that I want to devote more time to than we're going to have it for the end of this particular, of what we have left on the CD or tapes. Something more that, and it was one of the first things I thought of when I thought about doing this series, A Man After Yahweh's Heart. Something more that, again, I believe that demonstrates a part of at least what it was that prompted Yahweh to identify David as a man after his own heart. And again, I want to devote some time to it because it's one of those, for me, it's an amazing account of David and the kind of man, the kind of heart that he really had. Let that once again be our prayer. Let it be our desire. In fact, yea, let it be our earnest pursuit that we too might be considered, might be identified also by Yahweh as men and women with hearts like his. You know, could there be a better thing for a man to be identified as? Especially knowing that it's the heart that God looks at. You know, there's a lot of accomplishments, and all of us like to be praised and like to have our accolades for the things we've done in the past. But take all of the things that you've maybe accomplished in any other arena, or even as a Christian. Is there anything then that can match or that can better being identified by God as a man after his own heart? And I'd like to hear him say that someday. Talk about a sense to be knowing you're going to make it. Sometimes you may wonder, well, if you're wondering, you know, as Paul was, he says, "Man, I'm forgetting what lies behind and I'm reaching forward still for what lies ahead," knowing that he still needed to attain that. He needed to endure to the end. He needed to constantly check his heart. And Paul was the one who said, "Try your hearts, try yourself to see if you are indeed still in the grace of God." We need to seek and pursue that because there's nothing that can match to be known in that fashion, a man or a woman after the heart of Yahweh. All right, we'll pick it up with the wilderness of En-Gedi and what took place there. If you want a sneak peek, you can go ahead and read from here on, and you'll indeed see what it was. Or you can wait until next Sunday, and we'll cover it next Sunday. Let's stand, and we'll close this in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we are thankful to you again for your Word, for the lessons therein, and Lord, we do pray that we would learn the lessons. That we will learn, Father, from David, from the positive example, and from the negative examples of Saul and others as well, Father. Just help us to learn the lessons. And help us, Father, so that we don't have to keep taking the trip around Mount Sinai. Guide us and help us to learn the lessons, to trust and rely upon you, and to know that you always know best, no matter what the outward circumstances may appear. We love you and we praise you. We ask that you bless the message and use it to your glory for the furtherance of your kingdom and a blessing to your people. And it's in Yeshua the Christ that we pray. Amen.